I want to, of course, talk about Pesach, but at the same time, stay with our learning of the Sefer Achinuch. And so as I went through some of the previous shiurim I've given, I see that we have not spoken about mitzvah number 21. We've spoken about Pesach before in other mitzvot that the Sefer Achinuch has. Most importantly, I would say his mitzvah number 16 is a paradigmatic and perhaps the most important mitzvah connected to Pesach for the Sefer Achinuch, where he speaks about the importance of action that leads to belief rather than belief leading to action. But today we're going to look at his mitzvah number 21, which is the mitzvah of Sippur Yetziat Mitzrayim. And we're going to leave the Sefer Achinuch behind, but at least I want you to see how he begins. He tells us there's a mitzvah to recount the Yetziat Mitzrayim. There are many who hold that this is a distinct mitzvah from the mitzvah of Zichirat Yetziat Mitzrayim, right? Of remembering the Yetziat Mitzrayim. This mitzvah is connected specifically to Pesach and the Haggadah and the date of the 15th of Nisan, whereas Zichirat, remembering the leaving of Egypt, is a mitzvah that is incumbent upon us every single day, which we fulfill most often through the Shema. Now, what's unique about this mitzvah, the Sippur Yetziat Mitzrayim, as opposed to just simply the Zichirat? So the Sefer Achinuch points out that it is in response to telling your son. He asks you a question, and you shall vigadita, and you shall tell your son. That is the crucial verse that we're going to actually turn to again and again. The Higadita is the source of the word Haggadah, right? And you shall tell your son, this is what we're doing, Leil Seder. We are doing the Haggadah, which is based upon this verse in the Torah. The Sefer Chinuch then goes on, and I didn't bring it, with reciting to his son all the stages of his Haggadah, which more or less is the same Haggadah that we have today. What I want to add to what the Sefer Chinuch says is an addition of the Rambam. The Rambam says not only is there a mitzvah to tell the story of leaving Egypt, but you have to tell it in a certain format. And you see in the Rambam below, Chametzu Matzah, right, you see he says it's a positive commandment of the Torah to relate the miracles and wonders wrought for our ancestors in Egypt. Remember on this day which you left Egypt. Okay. From where is it that the mitzvah is derived on particularly the 15th? And you shall tell your son on that day, right? It's the same pasuk that we've seen previously. It is a mitzvah to tell your children. And then the Rambam writes, one should make changes on this night. He's basing it upon the Gemara and Psachim, most on page 116, but there are other places as well. That the children should see and they shall be motivated to ask, why is this night different from all other nights? And quotes the Gemara that gives you many different examples of how you could do things differently. Of course, our Arba Kushiyot, our four questions, are some of those things that we do differently, to which the answer, of course, is we're doing these things differently to provoke the interest of the child. The Rambam says other possible examples, give them roasted seeds and nuts. The table should be taken away, right? All these different ideas. And then this is the part that I wanted to just focus on for a moment. When a person does not have a son, his wife should ask him. If he does not have a wife, he and a colleague should ask each other, why is this night different? This applies even if they are all wise. A person who is alone should ask himself, why is this night different? What we're beginning to see is that, as I mentioned, the Rambam doesn't simply say there's a mitzvah to tell the story, but you should do it in the format of questions and answers. And others point out, for example, the Vilna Gaon and the Baal HaTanya point out that the format is actually what is most important. It is the format that is the derita of questions and answers. You can't simply start to tell the story. You must, as the Rambam points out here, you have to start with questions. You have to ask. And the question that I want to sort of focus on today is why? Why is the questioning that takes place during the Haggadah so essential to telling of the story? I mean, we can say, I think, a number of things outside, right, without looking at any sources. Certainly when we ask questions in general, this is a proper way of learning, right? It evokes interest. When people ask questions, if they're genuine questions, certainly, they want the answers, they're interested. There was a study done in the 1920s by a psychologist, with waiters taking orders at a coffee shop. And one of the things he noticed is that when a person still had not delivered the orders, they remembered everyone at the table and everything that they had ordered. The moment the food was delivered, they totally forgot everything else. And it wasn't simply because they had to remember beforehand, but he did subsequent studies to teach us the concept of dissonance, that when something is not yet complete, right? You haven't completely delivered the food to your clients. So there's dissonance. There's still something that's missing. And when something is missing, it helps alert and aliven your memory. And this is not just with waiters. This is life in general. When you start a task and you haven't completed it, it rests on you. That's why many people, when they advocate how you should overcome procrastination, is just do something for 2 minutes. You don't have to do the whole big job. Just start with 2 minutes. But it's a trick, because once you start something for 2 minutes, it bothers you when it's not yet complete. So you'll end up investing much more than those 2 minutes. And so this is also, I think, part of the educational value of questions, that when you ask a question and you really don't know the answer, you remain in a state of suspense and you want to know the answer. And therefore, it's a very effective educational tool to try to educate someone and be educated yourself. Very often when a person starts a talk, they will try to provoke questions, wonders in the person's mind, because if they do that, the person hopefully will be more interested because the answers are being suspended. We have other examples of this in the Torah itself. In fact, one of the commentaries points out that the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu was selected to be Moshe Rabbeinu, meaning to have the encounter with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, is because when he was walking in the mountains and he comes across the burning bush, the burning bush was there for other people to see as well. But no one really was bothered by it. No one asked the question, why is this bush burning? But it's only when Moshe asks, what's going on here? It's almost like a scientific question. He's bothered by, this is not the normal way of nature. When he asks that question, now God pops out and says, Moshe, you're the right person for me because you're curious. You ask questions. We saw the same thing with Avram Avinu, of course, also with regards to the Midrash, when he asks, why is this palace alight? And then God peeks out, because you've asked, right? Because someone asks is a sign of great interest and the ability to learn and develop. And that's what, of course, God is looking for in a leader. There are other reasons why starting with questions is important, especially for Pesach. One of them I would say is that asking questions is a sign that you are free, right? To ask questions means that you have the freedom to challenge authority. Someone says X and you could say Y, right? We don't have that freedom in some aspects of our lives. If you think about the army, don't ask, just do it. But being a free person and a slave can't ask, you know, why do I have to do this? But a free person says, why? What's the reason? What's the motivation? And so just asking a question should remind us of that, the fact that we are in fact free. There is a teaching, I think, from Rabbi Soloveitchik connected to this as well, of why you do not need to stand while learning Torah. You would think, perhaps learning Torah, you're learning the word of God, that we should stand up and show the proper respect. And he points out but because Torah learning requires asking questions and challenging authority, because that's part of the process, you don't have to do so. And perhaps when we lean Passover Seder, which is a sign of freedom, it's also hinting at that same element of freedom. I would suggest also a third reason that teaching of Rav Soloveitchik perhaps leads us to, is the reason why you have to ask questions is sometimes that's the way you get at truth. You can't always get at truth unless you're prepared to ask questions and make these challenges. If we go on the source sheet just down a little bit, this first source from Dvarim actually is the source of what I mentioned about Rav Soloveitchik. This has to do with tshuva. You know, in Dvarim, when God is telling us we can do tshuva, and he's talking about the Jewish people, Bikashtem misham et Hashem Elokecha umatzata ki reitir d'shenu. But if you search there for the Lord your God, you will find him. If only you will seek him with all your heart and soul. To which Rav Soloveitchik understands, if you want to see God, you have to first seek out God. God does not appear out of the blue. You do not feel God unless you have the desire and the yearning to want to connect to God. And that's what we've already pointed out with terms of the points of questions. Here I just brought a famous study of Solomon Ash on conformity. Many of you may be familiar with this experiment already. I'm bringing it for a different reason than usual. This study shows these two boxes that have lines in them. And you could see clearly that the target line and line C, right, they are in fact the same line. And basically what happened is seven or eight people are marched into a room. Seven of them are co-conspirators with the experimenter. And one is the innocent test subject. And they will show these two boxes and ask the individuals, can you tell us which lines are the same from the first box and the second box? And then the seven co-conspirators who already have been hired and already agreed upon ahead of time what they're going to say will all say, let's say, for example, they'll all say A. It's clearly not A. But if seven of them will say A, and now we get to the innocent, the test subject, what will he say? And in a majority of instances, even though it's clear that it's not A, because of the pressure of conformity, will say A, right? Just he'll make the mistake. I think in one instance, it was 30% of the people would say, in this case, that it was A. It's not 100%, but it's a large number of people who clearly make a mistake because of the power of conformity. And in other experiments, it goes much higher. When, however, the people are left on their own just to tell us what's right and what's wrong, 99.something% always get the right answer. So you see the power of conformity. What I like about this experiment is it was done additionally. And you would have everyone say, again, the wrong answer. Let's say they'd all say A. One person would get up, however, and the person would have a Coke bottle, glasses, you know, really, really thick, clear that they have a real tough time seeing, and they would give a different answer, but they'd still give a wrong answer. So they would say, let's say everyone in the room said A, they would get up and say B, which is clearly also the wrong answer. But just giving the wrong answer, right, a different answer, sort of a challenging the conformity encouraged by the other answers, would then allow the true person being tested to uniformly pick C. Right? Just a little bit of dissent from what everyone else was saying, even when the dissent itself was wrong, produced the possibility for a person to actually see the truth. They're able to break free from the conformity encouraged in the other experiments. And so we see that asking questions or expressing dissent, challenging, is how we as human beings very often get at truth. That's the entire premise of the chevruta system of learning, that you're not supposed to agree with your chevruta. It's through the challenging and the arguing and the asking questions and not being certain. It's the two swords that are clashing at each other. Both swords become sharper and we achieve truth as a result of it. So that might be another reason why the Seder has to do with questions, because that's how we get at truth. So those are a few different possibilities. It's helpful to learning. It's a way of expressing freedom. It's a way of getting to truth. The Chatam Sofer actually has an additional answer that I like very much. The Chatam Sofer says there's actually two types of questions. One of them is a query that you're trying to sort of ask a technical question. But the real goal of a question is to get at wonder, right? Meaning, wow, I'm just blown away by something and I can't really understand it. And therefore I have to ask a question. The Chatam Sofer says, that's what we're after at Seder night. We start with technical questions, but the real motivation is eventually to move those technical questions to a spiritual question and be filled with awe. I'm reminded of the famous statement from Abraham Joshua Heschel, who says that never once in my life did I ask God for success or wisdom or power or fame. The only thing I asked for was for wonder, that there's something very special about being in that state of awe. I want to expand on the Chatam Sofer's idea of Pella as a question and turn to a little bit of Hasidut and Rabbi Nachman in particular. What does he say the nature of the questions are on Leil HaSeder? He says these are a model, these questions, and we're actually supposed to get at real questions, questions that we really don't know the answer to. That's why they're called Arba Kushiyot. They're not Arba Sheilot, four questions. They are Arba challenges, four challenges that we're not going to necessarily understand. First of all, he says they're challenging questions. We should start asking at the Seder night challenges about ourselves, not just the global nature of what we're doing, but we should question ourselves, are we doing everything we can do in this world? Have we accomplished what we want to accomplish? Why do I have this failure? What are my strengths? Meaning we should ask personal questions and challenging questions. And then he goes on and says, and some of the questions we will not have satisfactory answers for. That's why they're meant to be challenging questions. Not every question will have an answer. And then he says, how do you then deal with that? When you don't have an answer to your question, what do you do? He references the wicked son. And he says that wicked son did not always start out wicked, but rather he had a genuine question. He really wanted to know, what does this mean? What's going on here? And then he did not receive the answer that was satisfactory. Maybe his question was deeper than what we think. Maybe his question was, why is there suffering in the world, right? The Jews are suffering so great. And so he was asking really a deep question. Why, in order for the freedom, do we have to experience suffering? And maybe people tried to give answers, but they weren't satisfactory. So the Rabbi Nachman then goes on to say, this happens to all of us. There are all of us experience questions that we just don't receive answers to. And now the real question is asked, what do you do when that happens? When you're not satisfied, when you can't find the simple or clear or right answer to your questions, what do you then do? So he says the failure of the wicked son was not his questions, but that after he didn't receive any satisfactory answers, he then gave it all up. And so therefore the answer of you blunt his teeth is not a punishment, you blunt his teeth, but you tell him to close his mouth. It's a piece of advice. It's telling him not everything can be answered. We have to live with uncertainty. That's what it means to be a human being, not to have clarity on all issues. We can't answer, we can't say, we can't speak and always offer insight. That's what Rabbi Nachman says we're trying to tell the wicked son, that you have to develop the ability to have faith even when there's not clarity. In fact, that's what faith is, right? It's one thing to have faith when everything is perfectly going your way and clearly understandable, but when it's not understandable, what do you then do? So I want to expand on this idea that the Rabbi Nachman has introduced us to and develop it a little bit further and its role, particularly in the Seder and in particular connected to the word Haggadah. As I mentioned before, now I'm returning to the sources. I said that the reason why we call our Haggadah Haggadah is because of this verse in Shemot that your son will ask you, and you will tell him on that day, saying, because God, for everything that God did and took us out of the land of Egypt. The Rav Tzadok HaKohen says that if you really want to understand a word, you have to see the very first time it appears in the Torah. So even though this is the source, of our Haggadah, which makes perfect sense, it's connected to the story of the Seder, the very first time the word higadata, or the root of to tell, Haggadah, does not appear in Shemot, but actually in Bereishit. In Bereishit, we're talking about Adam and Eve. They have sinned. They have eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They've fallen to the temptation presented to them by the Nachash, by the serpent. And now it seems that their eyes open up and they see that they are naked and they're embarrassed by their new state of nakedness. And at this point in time, Vayikra Hashem, and God calls out to Adam and he says to him, "Where are you?" He says to him, "I heard the sound of you in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid." Yomer, mi higid lecha. There's the word Haggadah. Who told you this? Who told you that you're naked? Have you eaten from the tree for which I have forbidden you to eat? So there's the first use of the word higid, Haggadah, of telling. So if we can kind of understand what the Haggadah there means, the telling, right, that God is asking, God uses the word, that God is asking Adam, who told you this? If we can understand what that telling involved, perhaps we'll get a deeper understanding of what our Haggadah experience is meant to be. Now, I want to offer two suggestions to this concept of Haggadah. One of them is less connected to Pesach, but I think it's an important insight in general. It's provided by Leon Kass, who wrote a book on Bereishit. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. And what he suggests, not per se on our particular question, but on these psukim, on these verses, about man being naked, and he was embarrassed by this nakedness. He connects it to the creation of Adam, and God tells us that it is not good for man to be alone. And now most people understand that verse as it is not psychologically good, emotionally good for man to be alone, but he actually says it's not good for man to be morally alone. In particular, not just alone existentially, as we'd say, perhaps, according to Rav Soloveitchik, but to think that he can be alone. The problem on a moral level is when Adam and human beings in general celebrate aloneness, which is to say, I don't need anything. I don't need anyone. I am a totally self-contained individual, right? The expression a self-made man, it's loved in the West. But I think it's abhorred in the Torah. There's no person who's self-made. Everyone has received something from others, from previous generations, from our families, from society, our communities. But Adam, he's created all by himself. So perhaps at this point in time, he feels aloneness, that he feels that he could accomplish everything he needs to accomplish in the world without ever having to rely on any other human being, and maybe even ever relying on God. And so God says, it is not good for man to be alone. It's not morally good if he thinks he never needs anyone else, that he will never have any connection or empathy with other people's and other people's needs. If he doesn't need, then he also won't be sensitive to other people's, that there's an immoral element to that. Then when he becomes naked, right? He eats from the tree, becomes aware. This is God telling him, you can't rely on aloneness. You're not going, I mean, God has already prepped this in a few other ways, introducing him to Chava, and they have to work together. But the big thing, says Leon Kass, is that when he sees his nakedness, he was naked before. It's just that he wasn't embarrassed by it. But what happened in the sin of eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, right? What's the knowledge of tree of good and evil is what I've just said. Good is connecting to others. Evil is feeling the power of you being alone is sufficient. So when he now eats from that tree, he looks at his sexual organ differently than he had previously. What does the sexual organ now represent to him? It represents to him that he has to have a child in order to fulfill his ultimate destiny, that he is not going to accomplish everything in the world all by himself, that he is going to die, right? As the Torah says, then you will know you will die. It's not that he wasn't going to die before, But now he understands that the death means that he will not accomplish everything and he has to leave something over to the next generation, which is symbolized by his sexual organ. Their sexual organs, because it's the organs of procreation. And so that, the Enkas argues, is why he's now embarrassed, that he sees the organs of procreation as a sign of weakness. But that's what God is educating to him, that he can't do it all by himself. He has to prepare the next generation as well. And in that sense, I guess we could say that there is a connection to Pesach, because the whole Pesach Seder is about educating not just ourselves, but also our children. I want to offer a different suggestion based upon what Rabbi Nachman was talking about of what really is taking place at this moment of Haggadah. And to do that, I'll ask a couple of questions. The first one is a question that Rav Soloveitchik asks on the Gemara in Shabbat 118. So in that Gemara, it says that whoever recites the Hallel Mitzri, the Hallel that talks about us leaving Egypt, the songs of Psalms that we praise God with, of splitting the sea and the mountains singing, these beautiful, beautiful words. Whoever says the Hallel Mitzri every single day is a blasphemer. And so Soloveitchik and others ask, wait, how can you be a blasphemer? You're praising God. You're saying God is providing this incredible miracle for the redemption of the Jewish people. Why should that be a negative? It should only be a positive. If we say it every single day, it should be to be praised, right? Harehi Meshubach, even more so. But at this point in time, the Gemara says, no, if you say it every single day, these praises of God, that it's as if you're a blasphemer. Why? Another question. The Netziv asks the question, why do we have four cups of wine? Now, he's not asking the symbolism of four. He's not asking even necessarily why wine, right? We have four because it's connected to the four Lashonot, the four languages of Geula, of redemption. And we know that the symbolism of wine, there's a few different connections. One is that it's connected to redemption. Very often it's celebratory. Others point out that it has to be red wine because it's connected to the story of Yosef and what the brothers did to Yosef and the blood that's involved. It's to remind us that's how we got into this situation, that we sold Yosef into slavery. No, but he's asking a different question. He says some of these same ideas could be fulfilled without wine. You could have matzah, right? We could have four matzot as representing the four languages of redemption. And you could have joy, right? Wine brings joy, and we're supposed to feel that in the redemption. You could have the joy through the Karban Pesach. We could have four pieces of meat, right? Ein simcha, bli basar v'yayin. So you have four pieces of meat. Why specifically wine? Rabbi Nachman says, listen, there could be a danger in wine. Right? When you drink wine, there's an element of danger in drinking that wine. In fact, we know this not only from the story of Purim, but we also know this from Rabbi Nachman as well. He suggests the reason why, with regards to the custom we all have at Kiddush, right? When you say Kiddush and then you say Savri, right, before you actually make the Kiddush and drink the wine, make the blessing over the wine, is because we all understand that wine could lead to dangerous results. If unchecked, uncontrolled, wine produces danger. And so therefore we are saying Savri, with the permission of everyone here, I'm about to engage in drinking of wine, I do it with your permission, your oversight, almost as if it were. And what does everyone respond when you say Savri? Everyone responds and says, L'chaim. May the drinking of this wine be for life, for good purposes. So Rabbi Nachman and others were aware that there's a danger in wine, but nevertheless, we do drink wine. This is the question that Netziv says. Why, if we could achieve the same results through matzah or something else, why specifically do we focus it on wine? And one last question I want to ask is about opening the door for Eliyahu HaNavi. Now, why do we do that? And I guess there's two elements to the question. The first question is, why do we do it when we do it? And there's perhaps historical explanations Many people suggest that we used to actually open the door at the beginning of the Seder when we say, whoever is hungry, come and let them eat. It was a genuine invitation, right? It was not just mere words. You opened your door and you yelled out, if anyone's hungry, come, now is the time. But because of blood libels and the danger often associated with Leil Pesach, the night of the Seder, when the blood libels really would hit a crescendo, it was too dangerous to open the door at the beginning. It might come and destroy the entire Seder. But if you open it at the end, then it's perhaps a little bit safer. There's another, I think, explanation that has a historical element. There's a different girsa in some Haggadot that doesn't say that you should lirot, see yourself as if you actually left Egypt, but rather laharot, that you should appear as if you yourself actually left Egypt. And some people pick up on that girsa, that change of language, and say we have to appear, meaning we should dress up. I remember my father always would dress up as Moshe Rabbeinu, and he would have a staff and a beard, fake beard, long beard, because he felt that you had to appear as if you were really leaving Egypt. And there are many customs. The Rambam says you have an obligation to play act and create minhagim that demonstrate your actual freedom to others. The Kaf HaChaim had one particular minhag where a child would dress up, he would tie the matzah to his shoulder, and he would say the halach manya. The child then would go to the door and knock on it. Someone would say, who is it? And he would respond, a Jew. From where are you coming? And he would respond, Egypt. To where are you going? He would respond, to Jerusalem. What are you carrying? And he would respond, matzah. And this actual custom of the Kaf HaChaim appears in a few Haggadot. And in some of the variations, there's one instance where they would add an additional question, and it was a question of disbelief. How could you have possibly escaped Egypt, right? No one escapes Egypt. There's the Midrash that says no one ever escaped Egyptian slavery except Hagar. And the answer is because Hashem has liberated me. And I wonder perhaps if this custom, where he go to the door and play act, maybe that's the source of opening the door, right? It wasn't just for to let people know that they could come in, but it was part of the play acting of someone coming along and you then asking them questions. In both cases, however, what's the connection to Eliyahu HaNavi, right? So even if you move it later, the opening of the door, why intimately link it with Eliyahu HaNavi, right? What are we trying to get at in this regard? It's almost Lahavdil, reminds me of like Santa Claus coming to every single door, every single chimney. Eliyahu has to come to every single door. Where did that sort of, Baba Maisa, that Eliyahu is going to appear. I don't want to say Baba Maisa, because if you had to believe a Maisa, your Bubba is a good person to believe it. But where does this idea come from? It reminds me of a joke I once heard between a young Jewish boy and a young Christian boy. And the Jewish boy was making fun of the ridiculousness of Santa appearing on one night, reaching every single chimney. And the Christian boy responded, says, you have Eliyahu HaNavi that goes to every single Jewish door. And the Jewish boy responds, says, yeah, but there are far few doors that he has to get to. The Jews are a small people. Christians, there's a billion of you. But it doesn't matter. They're both, on some level, seem more in the world of fantasy than reality. Why is it that we open the door for Eliyahu HaNavi? Why that opening the door to that connection? So those are a few additional questions that I think are gonna shed some light on the initial questions we spoke about. It was, what's that real Haggadah, that real telling taking place in Bereishit? So to answer these three, I want to look at an interesting Gemara in Shabbat. And because I'm going to read a lot, I only brought the English. Okay. And we don't actually need all of this here, but it's just a fascinating Gemara. I figured you might like to see it nevertheless. Right beforehand, it's talking about the shofar being blown on Rosh Hashanah and how we sort of evoke mercy from God through that entire experience. And the Jewish people will say before him, before Hashem, Master of the universe, to whom shall we go? Like, we need help. We need you to forgive us. We need mercy. Who can we turn to achieve this? Shall we go to Abraham, to whom you said, know certainly that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and they shall serve them, right? This is connected, of course, to the story of Pesach. We're going to eventually become slaves. Can we turn to Abraham? Because he knew about us being afflicted in the story of Pesach, but he did not ask for mercy on our behalf. When he was told this, he did not object and ask for mercy. So how can we go for it to him? Or perhaps we should go to Isaac, who blessed Esau and said, and it shall come to pass that when you break loose, you shall break his yoke off your neck. And he did not ask for mercy. So he also has a failure. Or maybe we should go to Yisrael. Maybe we should go to Jacob, to whom you said, I will go to Egypt with you. Well, why didn't he step in and ask for mercy for us if we were going to get stuck down in Egypt? So we can't go to any of them. So if so, who do we go to? Shall we go to our patriarchs who do not have mercy on us? Rather, now God himself says that we deserve our punishment. There's no one here to protect you. The Holy One, blessedly, said to them, since you made yourselves dependent on me, and you notice the link. The link now is being made between tshuva and shofar and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Pesach. The Pesach experience. In both instances, we are in dire need and we need forgiveness from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If your sin be like scarlet, he said to know, since you made yourself dependent upon me, but now God forgives us because of God, they will become white like snow. Apropos of the Jewish people assessing their forefathers, the Gemara cites a related teaching. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani said that Rabbi Yonatan said, what is the meaning of that which is written? For you are our father, for Abraham knows us not, and Israel does not acknowledge us. You, Lord, are our father, our redeemer, everlasting is your name. Now, as you read this, you'll notice from that verse, who's absent? Who's absent from this failing of really understanding us? And it's Yitzchak. It's Isaac. He's not mentioned. In the future that will surely come, the Holy One, blessed be he, will say to Abraham, your children have sinned against me. Abraham will say before God, Master of the universe, if so, let them be eradicated to sanctify your name, God. I mean, if they've sinned, okay, you have to punish them. And then God will say to Jacob, since he experienced the pain of raising children, perhaps he will ask for mercy on behalf of the Jewish people. He said to Jacob, your children have sinned. Jacob said before, Master of the universe, if so, let them be eradicated to sanctify your name. Meaning both Abraham and Yaakov do not defend the Jewish people at this point in time. They think it's the holier thing to do is let them be punished. Neither Abraham nor Jacob knew how to respond properly. He then says to Isaac, your children have sinned against me. Isaac said before him, Master of the universe, are they my children and not your children? At Sinai, when they accorded precedence to we will do over we will listen before you, didn't you call them my sons, my firstborn son Israel? Now that they have sinned, are they my children? Aren't they your children? So Yitzchak's got a little bit of a fight in him. And he challenges God and says, no, you have to take care of them. They're your children. And furthermore, how much did they actually sin? Now, this is a sort of a cute Talmudic logic placed into the mouth of Yitzchak. How long is a person's life? 70 years. Subtract the first 20 years of his life. One is not punished for his sins then. A person is only punished from age 20 onwards. 50 years remain. Subtract half that time because... half the time are nights. He doesn't sin during the nights. 25 years remain for him. Subtract 12 and a half years during which one prays and eats and uses the bathroom. Now we only have 12 and a half years left for a person to sin. If you can endure them all and forgive the sins committed during those years, excellent. If not, I'll take half of them upon me. And Isaac then goes on and defends the Jewish people. The Gemara is interesting for a number of reasons. As I mentioned, first of all, it's just an interesting Gemara seeing Isaac stepping forward. I mean, the logic and the argument he has with God. The question is, why is it Yitzchak? We never usually think of Yitzchak as the Redeemer, but here clearly it is. It's him. Now, since previous to the Gemara that I brought to you, we were talking about Shofar and Yom Kippur, perhaps we get a sense of why Yitzchak plays the role he does. He is in the Akedah, and that is an act that produces merit for the Jewish people. But of course, you could say the same thing about Avram. Avram is involved in the Akedah, and usually we think of Avraham's Mesirat Nefesh as the reason why the Akedah acts as a source of merit. But if you look clearly, you begin to see a distinction between how Avraham and Yitzhak not just act in the Akedah, but in general throughout their lives. One of the things you'll notice, and this is an insight from Rav Reim Cohen, is that Avraham relies on sight. He sees the animal caught in the thicket that will be sacrificed in place of Yitzhak. He sees in a number of instances the glory of God. He sees the palace on fire that we referred to earlier in the Midrash. He will travel to a land that God will show him, that he will see from afar, Har Moriah. Hashem appears to him, Avraham sees. When they go to Egypt, Sarah is seen. She's beautiful and appearing. Scientists use the concept of sight, rayot, right, as proof. Seeing seems objective, right? When you see, there's not room really for argumentation in the same way of some of the other senses, right? I took the trash out or I didn't take the trash out. My wife could see it, whether it's still in the kitchen or if it's not in the kitchen. There's no in-between. Seeing is about certainty. And that helped Avraham because Avraham had many, many tests, and you have to have a certain degree of certainty. The Gemara itself, by the way, uses the language, teda, teda, you will surely know. Avraham has tremendous certainty, and he wouldn't pass the test that God is challenging him with unless he had total confidence in himself and what he saw. But there are limitations in sight, and the Torah introduces us to those limitations. Think about Hagar, who doesn't see, right, the water that is close when her son Ishmael is dying, and she can't stand to see, right? Sight is too painful for her child suffering. And God almost gives her a tochacha, reproof, by giving the name Ishmael, that God will hear, right? We have to now think of a different source of trying to understand wisdom. You can't always rely on sight. The mitzvah shofar that we referenced earlier is a mitzvah of not sight, but a mitzvah of hearing. Again, we're relying on others. You see also the flaws in sight with Lot. Lot looks down and he sees the plains of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he sees that it looks good. It's a well-watered, right? Water is a sign of bracha. On Passover, we try to actually get rid of water, right? We can't have matzah with the water because you can't. It's blessing. It's clear blessing. Right? The Nile is filled with water. It's obvious. Whereas the water we rely on in Eretz Yisrael is the water that comes from rain, which is not as clear. So Lot looks down and he sees somewhere around and says, it's a good place, but he was wrong. There's rot underneath the obvious materialism of the land, which looks good, but there's spiritual rot underneath. And what's the punishment for that? Right? So, right, they're blinded. If you think about Lot and his guests, he hides the angels in his place, and the people who come to the door, pounding on the door, they have to be blinded. Or think about Lot's wife, who turns back to see. She has to turn into a pillar of salt. Or even Lot's daughters, what leads them astray is their sight. So sight is both what provides certainty, but it also provides a hidden danger at the same time. Avram seems to be able to maneuver the dangers. Like when God takes him out of the Brit HaBetarim and he says, look up at the skies, he can't see the stars. Partly because it's also daytime, he can't see the stars. But Avram knows that he has to rely on other senses. He can't rely just on sight. The sight gives him confidence, but he also has the ability to rely on other senses. But the person who really relies on other senses, of course, is Yitzchak, right? Yitzchak's eyes are weak. He can't rely on seeing something obvious in front of him. He has to hear, he has to listen, he has to make other judgments and see things that are not always so clear for him to see in order to get the big picture. I'd like to suggest that's what the Gemara is trying to teach us. And that idea is what is perhaps what's going on with some of those questions that I asked. Right, I spoke about, for example, how is it possible that someone who recites the Hallel Mitzri, the Psalms of praise of God for redeeming us from Egypt every single day, is somehow a blasphemer? Well, those are obvious miracles. God splitting the sea, the Makot, those are obvious. So if you sing that every single day, you're suggesting that that's the basis of your relationship of praise for God, because you see obvious miracles. And what we're supposed to really appreciate is that there are many non-obvious miracles that are taking place every single day. And if you can't ever see those miracles, right, the ones that are not clear to your eyes, so that becomes blasphemy of God, because you somehow suggest that God is related, is watching over us and protecting us back then, but not today, and not tomorrow, not average days, only on these spectacular, miraculous days. And so that might be part of what's going on there. It might also be part of what's going on when we open the door for Eliyahu HaNavi. I don't believe we're opening the door and actually expecting Eliyahu HaNavi to show up. It's not even that we want him to show up. That's not the statement of opening the door that's taking place. Opening the door is a statement of faith that even though we can't see, right, we can't see the future. That's one of the things that are hidden to us. But we believe in the future. We have an optimism. We have an emunah in the future that God will protect us and redeem us. So the opening of the door is not to see Eliyahu, but is to say that we believe in the coming of Mashiach and the protection of God and the redemption of God, even if it's not obvious to us at this exact point in time. And I think that's also connected to the Tzvi's question of the wine, right? The idea of the wine, there is a little danger, but what wine does is it changes our perspective. In addition to creating perhaps a greater sense of simcha, when you drink the wine, you feel a little bit different, and you need to begin to rely on other senses besides being totally in control. You're not totally in control, right? It brings me back to the idea of the wicked son who doesn't have an answer to his question. When you drink the wine, you're not necessarily going to be in total control. You're not necessarily going to be able to rely exclusively on your sight. You're going to have a different perspective as the night progresses to really appreciate what redemption is ultimately all about. And what I want to sort of conclude with is to take this idea and go back to the original question of Haggadah. In Bereshit, God says to Adam, who told you that you were naked? Now, what Rashi says there is, who told you that you should be embarrassed that you are naked? In other words, Adam knew that he was naked. That's not what God is asking him. God is asking him, why are you embarrassed by it? You knew that you've been naked since the beginning of creation, right? There was never a time that he could look down. He saw that he didn't have any clothing on, but he didn't realize what that meant. He didn't realize any of the significance of it until this point in time. So if that's true, what the real meaning of the word Haggadah is not telling us something we already know, but telling us something that we already know and then giving us a different perspective on that same knowledge of realizing that there is a difference. When we say, why is this night different? We know everything that's involved in it, but it still has to be somehow different than the previous year. We still have to learn something new about ourselves. We have to learn something new about the people with. We have to learn something new about the Torah, knowledge that we had, right? It's not trying to find more, but somehow going deeper. I think that's what Rabbi Nachman was getting at when he talks about why we have to have the questions. We ask the questions because the nature of Haggadah is to learn something new, or I should say learn a chidush about something we already knew. We ask questions, and these are obvious questions, right? Why do we ask the same questions? If it was really to provoke interest for us, you know, for much older, we've heard these questions many, many times. That's the whole point. And that's why some commentaries point out there's a machloket. Do you have to ask these specific four questions, or can you ask any question? And those who hold that it has to be these four specific questions, I think what their point they're making is the whole nature of question is to do the same thing, but now somehow feel that it's different, that it's a new experience. That's what the Haggadah is supposed to be for us. And that's the experience we're looking forward to, and I would guess about 10 days' time. And I wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom, and also a great Seder. We will meet again after Pesach. Shabbat Shalom to everyone, and Chag Kasher V'Sameach.